from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. In this hour of Forum, it was the ultimate Made in America event at the White House this week. President Obama hosted hundreds of students, entrepreneurs, engineers, and others for the first White House Maker Faire. The goal was to promote U.S. innovation and ingenuity. That would explain the 17-foot robotic giraffe on the South Lawn. We'll talk with Dale Dougherty. He's fresh from Washington, where he joined the White House festivities. He'll join us on Forum right after this. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. The do-it-yourself movement has taken the Bay Area by storm, and this week in Washington, it got a major boost at the highest levels of government. President Obama hosted the first ever Maker Faire at the White House. It was a showcase for ingenuity and offbeat inventions, like a marshmallow cannon built by a 17-year-old student from Arizona. There were plenty of participants from the Bay Area, including my guest. Dale Dougherty is founder and CEO of Maker Media in Sebastopol. They publish Make Magazine, which has helped to spur the do-it-yourself or DIY movement worldwide. Dale, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about, set the scene for us at the White House this week. What was it like?
Well, it's hot. and you know, we basically had to get lots of makers inside the White House and set up along, you know, the corridors at different levels. And, you know, it's not at all like setting up one of our regular events. And to some degree, a degree of secrecy surrounded it. So nobody quite knew who was going to be there, who was invited or
The White House invited, but no one, didn't know all the people who were going to be there.
Yeah, we assisted them and helped them. But then, you know, it was a convening, really, of lots of different, I think, supporters and contributors to the maker movement. And so, you know, in various rooms, there would be small tables and makers, just like at Maker Faire, have their objects set up or their devices.
Give us a sense of the range of things that were set up.
A lot of 3D printing. There was a 3D printed bust of the president, which came from the Smithsonian, actually looked pretty good. You know, there was a weather balloon kit from Public Laboratory that was out on the lawn. You know, take a weather balloon and put it in space and with instrumentation and take pictures or measure temperatures. The most popular and probably the photo moment was Russell the electric giraffe, which
17 foot tall,
with Lindsay Lawler from L.A. And Lindsay's been a staple at all the Bay Area Maker Faires and from the very first one in 2006. And so
I understand the president liked the giraffe's ears.
He did. And so, you know, we brought a bunch of people in and then kind of cleared them out. And then the president went through and visited some of these, you know, exhibits and talked to the makers. We had young makers. I was showing you a device made by Quinn Etnires from Central Coast in California. He's a 13-year-old, and he has got into making. He has a website. He makes kits and sells them. He does all kinds of interesting things. And, you know, I wrote about him, and we'll talk about education later. But, you know, these are kids that have kind of figured this stuff out, and they're just moving very fast, doing interesting things.
And how is what they do different from, say, what we might have learned in, you know, industrial arts or shop, as we used to call it?
I think it's very closely related. The trouble is there are fewer and fewer opportunities today to have that experience of even a shop class. There's a steady decline of them. And I think that's something we should talk about. I had some meetings, and I think this is some of the hope that events like the White House Maker Faire will encourage our educational system to embrace learn by doing again and value and not just the educators, it's actually also the parents, understanding the role that this plays in developing the skills and capabilities around science and technology, but also the mindset. And I think that's the real special part that I'd like to talk about today.
And is that why the president, you think, was so enthused? I mean, there was a great photo that I saw of him watching a marshmallow being launched from a cannon. And by the way, how did the Secret Service feel about cannon coming into the White House?
That was at a previous science fair. We had nominated Joey Hudy, who's a young man from Arizona, who was a 13-year-old, went there and as part of a science fair celebration. And so most of the kids at the science fair have the traditional posters, things taped on them and they're standing next to them. Joey brought this extreme marshmallow cannon that's painted orange. And the Secret Service told him, under no circumstances are you to shoot that off in the Oval Office here or wherever that was. And the president came by and said, does it work? And Joey said, sure, it works. You want me to show you? And so the president used a bicycle pump to fill the chamber with air and then released it. And everyone in the room just sort of gasped. Oh, my goodness.
First cannon since probably the War of 1812 on the White House lawn.
That's right.
And so coming back to education, I mean, that is really, you think, why the president is so enthused about this? Or is it more about manufacturing, economic development?
I think there's education and innovation, I think, are part of this story. I think there's something here that's very personal. There's something that's very social going on. And I think we're just starting to understand some of the economic implications. And I think the personal and social parts are really tied to education quite a bit. And again, not just kids, adults, lifelong learning. Really, I started the magazine because I thought these things were fun to do and they're engaging and you'd want to do them if you had some free time. And to some degree, we use technology quite a lot in our lives. And why don't we start to play with it and make things? And so when you're sending a homemade rocket up into near space with fancy cameras and things to do that, you can do something that you would have had to been part of NASA to do that 10 years ago, right?
I think a lot of people, when they hear DIY, do it yourself, I mean, they think of, making jewelry or macrame was that at the very earliest stage? I mean, that's been going on for decades. What has accelerated it to be what you just described?
Right. Well, I think there's what I call sort of low tech and high tech here. It can be traditional crafts, I think, are part of the maker movement. There are, in some ways, it's reframed a little bit here. But these are practices that sometimes have been forgotten even and abandoned and giving them like sewing, for instance. I'll ask an audience of older women, for instance, if they learned to sew when they were young, and they'll say yes. And in many ways, the sewing machine was the first machine into homes, and then to some degree, that wasn't necessarily passed on. And now we have a new generation that's not necessarily learning from parents, but they're learning, out in the community in various ways and finding non-traditional uses for sewing machine, which could be like sewing kites or sail fabric. And we visited the America's Cup last year, and they had these huge sewing machines, to create the sails.
Industrial-sized sewing machines.
And his, he said, my father was did this, and I'm in the tradition of it. But I think the important thing, I think what happened, the internet allowed us to share these things, and that's the accelerant initially.
Share them in terms of ideas
sell them? Both ideas, but just to take a photograph of your project and say, here's what I do. It's content for your blog. It's something that you put in your social media stream. I did this, and here's what I do. So I think that's kind of the very basic personal side of it. I think what sometimes DIY in the past was framed like the Depression era as an economic necessity. It was something you had to do because you were very much resource constrained, right?
Yeah.
And today I think it has more to do with personal expression. This is something I made. I'm proud of it. And what I saw when we started Make was that to some degree we have views on perspectives on this, say in cooking and woodworking. We have magazines. You buy it if you like to cook. You read magazines with recipes in them. And I thought in technology, you know, for the most part, we don't have that kind of magazine. We don't have that kind of how to do things, how to put lots of skills together. And I think that's what I wanted to initially see. And I went back at the time and looked at some old magazines like Popular Science, Popular Mechanics from the 1950s and much earlier, because many of them are 100 years old. And I felt there was this same idea in those older magazines of you could make anything, you could do stuff. And it was a real positive, fun spirit that I think if you hang around technical people today, what we sometimes call hacking, you know, I can do that. I know how to use those tools to do that. So Make is kind of transferring some of that attitude from the internet and software into the hardware and physical world and say, you know, we want to customize the world around us. We want to personalize it. We want to have impact. We want it to be the way, you know, we want it to shape or conform to our idea, not just accept the way it is.
Dale Dougherty is our guest this hour. He is the founder and CEO of Maker Media. We're talking about the DIY movement and this week's Maker Fair at the White House. Give us a call. I'll open the phone lines early this hour. I have a feeling a lot of people might want to weigh in on their own DIY experiences or their ideas or ones perhaps they have for their school or their class. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Again, that's forum@kqed.org. And you can always leave us a comment on our Facebook page or tweet us as well. It's at KQED Forum is the handle there. If you would, Dale, talk about how this all relates to the sort of the core curriculum, you know, that we're talking about in this country, the STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math. I mean, does the president see this movement, do you think, as part of engaging kids in the classroom?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's been a national agenda around STEM, but I don't know how successful it is really, because I think the goals are valuable to get more kids into science and technology, but I don't think they really know how. And my insight is that basically most of the people that I know that got into science and technology benefited from a set of informal experiences before they had much formal training in this. And I mean like building rockets in the backyard, tinkering, playing with things. And that created the interest and the motivation to pursue science. The Maker Movement in some ways is about practice over theory. And many previous generations of scientists and engineers had that body of practice before they went to school, say to the university. What we find today is the schools haven't changed, but the students have. They don't show up with much practice. Someone teacher was talking about even a class he was teaching, and someone was trying to hammer a drywall nail with great difficulty. You know, they didn't even have that level of experience.
Wow.
This is at the college level.
Wow.
In an engineering program. So, you know,
what does that tell you?
Well, it tells you that we, even at the university level, we're choosing talent based on math scores, not on capabilities and demonstrated abilities. If you applied to art school, they'd ask you for a portfolio of things you do. If you applied to engineering school today, they just look at your scores. And I'm trying to push, and I think others are, to make portfolios a more important part of an admissions process into college. MIT announced last summer, partly through our prodding them and their own interests, that their admissions process would have a maker portfolio option so that a student applying to MIT could say, here are a bunch of projects I did. Go look at them on the web.
Let's bring our listeners into the conversation. We have a number of callers already on the line. Let's start with David in San Francisco. David, welcome.
Hi. Good morning. I'm on the Golden Gate Bridge, by the way, driving. How great is that? So I have a question. I've been toting around this fabulous idea for years, but I'm not a technician. I don't have the technical skills to make the idea. And I was wondering if you have any kind of recommendation for connecting with makers where we could collaborate, and I could bring the idea, and somebody would help me engineer the idea, and then we'll become rich together.
Good question. Dale?
It's a great question. And it's important. You have the idea, so that's a great place to start. And I think really this whole movement is about turning ideas into reality. We have emerging these spaces called maker spaces. They are places where you can get access to tools and materials and often mentorship in making things. One of a commercial version of that is Tech Shop here in San Francisco. And, it's like a gym membership. You can get access to this. But they also have some people there who can help you talk through this idea. But that's kind of the formal side. The informal side is you'll begin rubbing elbows with other people who are working on projects, and you'll be able to talk to them about your idea. And sharing it with them, you might be able to do that. We see this happening in a number of makerspaces in some cities. There's a number of them around this area that are more club-like. Small groups of people get together, and they tend to do training and help people learn how to become skilled as makers. But they're also very cooperative in the nature, so you could help find this. I think eventually online you'll be able to meet and match up with people that you might, and you know, like build a team in the way that sort of open source software has allowed people to work together across geographic boundaries and time zones. And I think that's going to be important. I think we're going to see a shift from this sort of DIY world we've been talking about into more complex projects really require teams and coordination of groups of people. And in the past, that's been done through companies. Now I think these projects can be self-organized, like this gentleman is calling in. He can find some of the talents, and for modest amounts of capital even, do a prototype and get something.
David, does that respond to your question?
It doesn't, but how do you protect the idea so that if it's a unique idea, that you preserve that so that you can take it to market? How do you protect that?
Well, I think there's two paths on this. One is you don't protect it, because it might be more valuable to spread the idea and see what happens to build the community of people. The second way is you meet those people and say, I want to form a project, and either there's some agreement or contract between you not to share that information. So, I think both paths we see happening today.
All right, David, good luck. Look forward to hearing about your idea one day. Let's go back to the phones. Another San Francisco caller, Peter, is on the line. Good morning. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
Well, this is something I've been involved in all my life. I make handmade products, 19th century reproductions. We have a shop. We've been in the city for the last 40 years. I've trained dozens of guys, women too. We make metal castings. We've worked on hundreds of historic buildings. I'm planning on writing a book called Vanishing America, because our building stock from the 19th century is being torn down. And I got to tell you, I'm so excited about the possibility that somebody could realize what the potential is.
Peter, what are some of the buildings you've worked on locally?
Locally, City Hall.
In the restoration, when they did the restoration there?
Yes. I'm working on the War Memorial. I'm working on the War Memorial Veterans Building now. Numerous public library projects with the restoration of libraries all over the city. Oakland City Hall, Alameda City Hall.
Okay.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
And then about 15 or 18 state capitals making their hardware, lighting fixtures for the Michigan State House.
What do you make of this movement of so many other people kind of doing it on their own now?
Well, I think that if you are drawn to craft, that anything you can do and anything that happens would be spectacular, and I've been pitching this for years, and I don't know whether I can get through to people, but. The more we get into this century, the more impoverished we will become if we don't train people to make things that are beautiful and maybe useful. Hinges from the 19th century are just spectacular. You know, I'm a metal caster, a pattern maker. I make drawings. I figure things out in my head. I do engineering work, metallurgical work, all related to craft.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guys around here. We did the Board of Supervisors chamber. We made the handicap ramp in there. You know, I mean, we need to do this. We need to get people doing things like this.
All right. Well, we got the message.
In an office. Yeah. Not everybody belongs.
All right, Peter, thanks so much for your call. I had a lot to say. And Dale Doherty, got to love the enthusiasm.
Absolutely. Well, that's actually the thing that really made me feel there was this was so important was the enthusiasm of people around this idea. But, you know, I think this gentleman speaks a bit about how there's a feeling that this has been marginalized and forgotten and moved out to the edge of our society. You know, we talk about software and we love all the digital technologies, but you know, when he says metal casting or pattern maker, you know, these are things that may become lost arts if we don't sort of embrace them. And the interesting thing, and this is again why I think the president says there are jobs here. There's real work to be done. Yes. And it's hard to find people to do it.
Yeah. Let me read an email here. One listener writes, in the past, there were always technology-related clubs hosted at universities and schools, but the Maker Faire franchise seems to want to expand like Starbucks, installing itself in every city that it can. Is it healthy to have one corporation take over what had formerly been organized by common people? Does everything have to have a price tag on it and a marketing campaign associated with it? And are corporate sponsorships actually a good thing? What if corporate representatives are stealing the good ideas they encounter at Maker Faires?
Well, that's kind of a pointed question, isn't it? So, you know, this year there'll be 123 Maker Faires around the world just as of this date. This weekend there's a Maker Faire in Paris and next weekend in Barcelona. Small town in Texas, McAllen, on the border is doing a Maker Faire. You know, the interesting thing about most of the Maker Faires, most of those, except for the ones we organize around here, they're really organized by the people that want to have it come to their town. We realize that, you know, we build the Maker Faire here in the Bay Area. It's 130,000 people that come. It's a big, complex event. But people are asking, can we do it in Seattle or can we do it in Kansas City? And we had to come up with a model for doing that. So we wanted it to be in some ways consistent and connected in the spirit of what we're doing. So we came up with guides for how people can do it. So anyone really can apply to create a Maker Faire. And if they know what they're doing and we try to help them do it, they can be successful. And I think it's really valuable. We see them in schools and libraries. So, you know, I get the anti-corporate, anti-whatever it is here in this message. But this is also sort of a popular movement where it's not dependent on me or anybody else. It's really distributed like a social network. People create a node and they attach it and they say they're part of this.
And just quickly, are you concerned about corporations coming into these fairs and stealing ideas and, you know, making money off them?
You know, I'm actually happy to have them there. And I think if you went and asked the makers themselves, they don't think of corporations coming in to steal them. They think there's real opportunity here to work together. You know, it's easy today to make a prototype of something. It's still pretty hard to manufacture lots of those things and distribute them and put them in a lot of people's hands. So companies, you know, we do have toy companies. We have large companies like Intel coming. But there's I think, a complementary relationship. They're actually providing new, cheaper components for people to build things, and that creates, you know, better ecosystem.
All right. Dale Doherty from Maker Faire and the editor of Make Magazine. He'll be with us for the rest of the hour. We'd love to hear from you. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Tell us what's on your mind this morning. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. Lots more to come. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning. My guest, Dale Doherty. He is the founder of the Maker Faire, editor of Make Magazine. He was at the White House this week along with other entrepreneurs and tinkerers and innovators, students, to talk about the DIY movement, the maker movement in the country. If you want to join us, the number 866 excuse me, 733-6786 is the number to call. And let's go right back to the phones. We got a lot of calls this morning. Resma in Mountain View, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. This couldn't be a better time. I know I'm the third caller from the Bay Area, but what can we do? We are all makers here.
That's fine.
I actually was at the Computer History Museum just dropping off my fifth child at the Girl Make Games. It's a coding class for girls. And as a science fair enthusiast, I've been running science fairs at the elementary school for almost 15 years and have seen the poster with the president and the marshmallow cannon. So when I tuned in the radio, I was like, this is interesting. I need to call in and pitch in my support for the STEM programs at schools.
And are you focusing on girls, did you say?
Well, this time I have a daughter, so this is my fifth child. So I found out about this Girl Make Games. It's a three-week course where girls create video games, and it's at the Computer History Museum. It's by my friend. But I'm actually a full supporter of STEM. I've been doing chairing science fairs at schools through the Synopsis Foundation at the Saratoga Elementary School. And I cannot tell you how important it is to have the hands-on creativity amongst the children from a very, very young age so that they get the fear out of building things. And
particularly girls, I would think. I mean, just
girls and,
when there's technology
in this case,
involved.
I realized with the girls making games, when the girls are in their room by themselves, they are less shy to come up with their own ideas. And I noticed a lot of girls are readers, so they actually create their imagination through books that they read. So there's a lot of creativity going on. But I just wanted to actually share that you guys were asking about, you know, how can this be improved? How can we have more creativity in the kids? And my personal input, I have six kids, and this is my fifth child going to the Girl Maker game. Definitely exposing your children to all sorts of things, whether it's in the kitchen or, you know, out in the garden, it does help to create the motivational skills and also the motor skills.
All right.
Where, you know, if you have a device that breaks down, just open it up and show what's in there for kids.
All right. Resma, thanks so much for the comments this morning. What else can parents do, Dale? A lot.
And I think this is part of the real growth of maker movement, really, and things like Maker Faire. Our parents are coming, bringing the kids, and they see that the kids are really interested in this stuff and that they want to do it. And they don't actually get it in school. So, you know, if parents can support this, and it is not necessarily about getting 3D printers into the home for them. It can be done with cardboard. It can be done with the simplest materials. And some of these projects that even we would have in the magazine, you could have done them 50 years ago. They were fun then. They're fun today. And we see parents wanting to get out and do things together with their kids, not just, in a sense, sit behind the iPad like we used to talk about sitting behind the TV. And there's almost like a tactile deficit among kids today because they aren't doing things. And when we have these activities, I'm always stand back and watch some of the kids that it's almost aggressively manipulating and touching things because they're not used to it. And I think what we see is parents watching their kids, seeing how they're engaged, and then they just, there's a lot of simple things we can do at home to make this happen.
All right, let's go to Santa Clara now. Dave is on the line with another education-related topic. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Dale. I tried to get Riley up out of bed, but he's still asleep.
Oh, hi, Dave.
How are you, man?
Good.
So I've been running a makerspace on my own for public schools for the last 4 years. I've had about 150 kids come through it. Dale's familiar with what we've been doing. In fact, a couple of my kids have been speakers at Maker Faire. The big challenge I've got right now is leaving middle school and heading for the high schools. We're getting no traction to get these makerspaces going. Been working with Project Lead the Way, Pathways to Engineering, a couple of other ones.
Resistance? What are they saying?
Inertia. What you're doing doesn't fit our previously established program. And a lot of the kids that I've been working with are going in with more skills than they know what to do with within the programs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what I hope comes out of things like the White House, is that it starts to tip the scales a bit in favor of integrating this into the school. You know, I believe creating a makerspace inside of schools gives kids the opportunity to do things. I don't really care whether it's a particular course or not. But, you know, Quinn that I mentioned earlier, I wrote about in the magazine, his superintendent called me from his school district and said, Quinn, who's a 13-year-old, came before the school board and told him, you know, about what he had done.
This is the giraffe maker?
No, this is the young man that
makes
the little switches, little kits. And, you know, they said he'd been to Maker Faire. He'd been to Maker Faire Rome, where he met the mayor of Rome and did all these things. And they said, well, where did you learn this? And he said, outside of school. And the superintendent didn't like that answer a lot. And they asked Quinn, what should we be doing? And makerspaces were the top thing he said. And I think what was so fascinating there is he said, just like Dave is saying here, I'm a middle school. I'm in eighth grade. I'm graduating from this. I'm not sure which high school I should go to because I don't see this being supported there. And I think I think kids are going to be the drivers of change in this. They're going to be the ones asking for it. And if their parents can help support them, we have to get in there, create town hall meetings at the school, raise this, you know. One of the great analogies I have for these maker spaces in schools is the school garden. How did it get there? Well, we know Alice Waters and Berkeley and the Edible Schoolyard Project, and they kind of inspired and initiated. But it was the effort of a lot of parents to go out and say, you know, I'm going to just ask if I can have that little plot of land. I'm going to set up a raised bed garden. I'm going to set up the irrigation. And, you know, at the time, there was no budget. There was no staff. There was no curriculum. Now there's all three of those things, and there's almost a school garden everywhere. So if we could get parents to do this for makerspaces in schools, I think we'll see them there.
All right, Dave, thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from a listener who writes, please ask Dale about the results of the DARPA grant. That's the Defense
Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Yeah, and for getting makerspaces into schools and whether or not there's a follow-on effort to extend the effort and perhaps train teachers in the related curriculum.
Yeah, great question. We were awarded a DARPA mentor grant, and it lasted until February 2013 when sequestration kind of dropped it. But we, at the time, established makerspaces in 16 high schools around the Bay Area.
What does that mean exactly?
A makerspace? Think of it like as a combination computer lab, shop class, art studio, workshop. And really, it can be a set of high-end tools, but it could be hand tools, power tools. There are places like the Nueva School. You know, private schools have them almost all these days. What we lack them is in public schools, in particular urban public schools. And so we wanted to pilot this and do the training to get teachers up to speed. You know, even though the funding for that program went away, I was really proud to realize this spring that all 16 of those spaces not only were still in existence, they had expanded, the number of students they were serving had grown. We created materials like on makerspace.com. There's a handbook for how to create a makerspace in a school. You can download it for free. So I'm hopeful that, again, some of the White House stuff may allow us to continue that work in a different form. We have an Oakland-based nonprofit called the Maker Education Initiative that is also promoting this and trying to work with schools and train teachers.
All right. Back to the phones now, and Lafayette is our next stop. Steve, good morning. Welcome.
Hello there. I have a son who's been kind of the beneficiary of a comment you made about schools looking at more than just grades for admissions. He is a mechanical engineer and graduated from Cal Poly and applied for several years to Cal and only did it when he finally showed one of the professors there a device he had made by himself. He has gone to Maker Faires.
What was it, Steve?
It was using a vortex-induced vibration on an oscillating ball that contained a gyroscope.
And don't you love it?
Of course it is, yeah. That's what I thought it was, but go ahead.
Why didn't I
do that? Well, if you remember, when we were kids, we had that little thing that had the gyroscope in it, and if you turned it, twisted it in certain directions, it accelerated, and if you twisted it in other directions, it had resistance. And so with that knowledge, he went ahead and created it.
Yeah, and so that impressed the folks at Cal.
Yes, and his grades were not sufficient, and he got into a master's program there and was swamped by the math. It really is the reliance on math was a bit daunting. Then they worked for a few years in startups around the Bay Area in robotics and was delivering a paper in the Virgin Islands last year, or year, 2 years ago, I guess it was. And there was somebody from MIT in the audience and suggested that he toss in a an application over the transom. And he's now in a graduate program at MIT, mechanical engineering.
Wow, good for him. So, Dale, that you know, math.
Yeah.
Do you have to know math and or at least have some willingness to learn it?
I think so. You know, one of the interesting things of those 16 places, that makerspaces we created, the lead teacher in about 6 to 8 of them were math teachers. And I don't completely understand why, but here's what I think is many of them taught remedial math. And these are like 2-year programs that could be taught in 1 year if you were sufficiently motivated. And so a lot of what has to do with math is kids feel defeated by math. They're told they're not good at it.
Especially girls.
Right. And so how can we change their attitude? How could math just be another tool in the tool chest? You know, and in many ways it can be, because you make something like a car or a drone or a rocket, and you want to know how does it work and how fast is it going or how high is it going, and that involves math. And so it might involve simulation. One thing this gentleman mentioned, though, that I think is really important you know, the context of making is playful. And so getting kids to play, even in high school, this is what really drives me crazy at the high school level. That's when it stops being fun. And we should really be asking ourselves, you know, if we're really about STEM, you know, how do we make it fun? How do we make it engaging? How do we keep it playful? Because they kind of have that experience in elementary school, and we keep stripping that away.
All right, Steve, thanks very much for the comments there. Let's go to San Rafael. Amy, welcome.
Hi, this is Amy. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm in my 50s, and I grew up in a time with parents who were do-it-yourselfers, partly because they loved to make things. My mother sewed our clothes, and both of my parents made their own furniture in their house that I grew up in. It's still there. And in fact, my mom was turning a lamp base on a lathe in the wood shop class at the high school where they were learning how to make furniture when she started labor pains with my older brother. So that's a story that we like to share. But what I wanted to mention was that as a lot of us get busy and more affluent and can hire people to do things for us, sometimes we forget that real deep satisfaction that comes from solving something ourselves or going to the hardware store and figuring out how to make something or build something or create a solution. And that even, you know, the kids, it's good for the kids to learn how to do these things. It's also good for the parents to maybe learn or remember that satisfaction that comes from doing things ourselves. Yeah. And I'm really excited to see that coming back around.
Well, thanks. It's almost, Dale, like she's saying, that these kinds of things really add meaning to people's lives.
Absolutely. You know, the key idea here that I've kind of promoted is that I want people to see themselves as producers, not just consumers. And we're not that satisfied often by things we buy. And things we make, things we create, give us that meaning. And again, we do it for gifts. You know, we do it to give something that we make to someone that's more meaningful than just buying it. We do it with food. We do it in lots of areas. So I think she's right on. And, you know, connecting, you know, it's not necessarily cheaper or faster or easier to make something than buy it, but it's a lot more meaningful.
Yeah. All right, Amy, thanks so much for the call. 866-733-6786 is the number if you want to join us on forum with Dale Doherty. 866-733-6786. Let's go now to Livermore. Eric, welcome.
Yeah, how's it going?
Good.
When my daughter was young, our toaster bailed, and she's like, well, got to buy a new toaster. I'm like, I don't think so. Let's see if we can open it up and find out what's wrong. Sure enough.
I hope you unplugged it.
Well, yeah. But she figured it out. She said, oh, cool, this wire came, you know, broke right here. We fixed it. And then I went to St. Vincent de Paul and bought a bunch of old blenders and all drills, you name it, a whole bunch of equipment. And here's a screwdriver and wrenches, knock yourself out. And she tore them all apart and put them back together and just learned how various things worked. And you can do that with batteries and light bulbs and no instruction, just knock yourself out, you know, and see what will, hopefully, be careful,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and see how things work yourself. And, you know, you're always got to be there to help them if they have questions.
Yeah.
But.
Dale, is this something that you think is just innate in all of us if you just find a way to tap into it?
Yeah, I do. You know, but it's a lot of things. You know, we don't know if it's innate if we don't try to practice it. You know, it's like music ability or any other things. But I think the gentleman was talking about it, just like take apart or repair. It starts to build up a vocabulary of what are these components inside of things? How do they work together? And sometimes how do they fail?
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Eric. Here's an email from someone who writes, I work with many upper middle class families who send their kids to private schools and have seen over the past year that many of these institutions are beginning to offer maker classes. However, I'd love to see these made accessible to middle and low income students in public schools. This would require some level of sponsorship for public school teachers to learn tech skills in maker spaces, and then they could bring them to the classroom. And so the writer is wondering if that might be possible.
Well, certainly part of the focus of the DARPA grant was to do that. And it is part of the focus of – it is exactly the focus of our nonprofit Maker Education Initiative to take this, and in some ways, we even had some of those schools participating in our program because they could share what they're learning, and we can apply that to other folks. It's going to take some resources, and it's going to take some will. That's why I think parent engagement around this is critical, and also community engagement, because it's, you know, you may not have the parents in those communities active enough to be organized around this. So, I believe right now we in affluent middle class communities, we see making a headway. We don't see that in low income communities yet, and I think this is where the Department of Education wants to take a role, State Department of Education, and then, you know, school boards and districts, they need to ask, what are our kids missing if they're not getting this? And what are the opportunities that we're that we could create for them?
The last part of that email, by the way, said the tech shop offers free 1-year memberships to vets.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe they could do something similar for public school teachers.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of it is getting, it's getting a champion teacher in a school that wants to make this happen is a key piece of it.
All right. Let's go back to the phones in San Francisco. John, welcome.
Hi there. My name's John. I live in San Francisco, but I represent the San Jose Public Library. And we've got some great initiatives in the works. We're calling it STEAM Stacks. That's STEM plus the A for art. And we're going to renovate some spaces in our libraries to be more creation spaces rather than just consumption of media and information. For example, this summer we've got a program on squishy circuits, which is conductive Play-Doh, LED lights, and batteries to let people know that it's really easy to work with simple materials and learn that, you know, they can work with technology and electricity and learn a little bit about what where they might take that next.
That's great. You know, Dr. Emery Thomas from Minneapolis, Minnesota, was at the White House demonstrating squishy circuits as a project she came up with, and we've had in the magazine. It's a wonderful beginner project for young kids.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Don in San Jose, welcome. You're next.
Hi. Very interesting program. Wanted to mention a few things. You've already covered a lot of the points that I thought were important. I'd like to recommend a book called Shop Class as Soulcraft.
Okay. What's it about? Well, who wrote it?
Actually, I don't have
Matthew
the author's
Crawford.
Title here.
Matthew Crawford. There you go.
Yeah, right. So you know the book.
I do know the book and know the author.
I've bought it and I haven't finished reading it yet, but I think it's a great book. A couple of other things I wanted to say is that I took shop class in high school, metalwork and woodwork, and I think especially the metalwork was valuable to me as an engineer. And I'm dismayed to see how many schools have dropped shop class. Do you know why that is?
Well, I was talking to a group in D.C. yesterday about this, and they're looking at trying to reframe what shop class was and use some of these Perkins grants to schools to bring it back. But I think the number one reason is parents didn't believe it was important for their children to take shop class. It was not going to get them into a better school, and they didn't want to be in a trade. we're rethinking that now, that this is an enabler for engineering and other practices, design as well. So I think we'll see a resurgence of that. I'll just mention that shop class at Soulcraft, Matthew was an investment banker, I believe, in New York, who just grew dissatisfied with that and opened up a motorcycle repair shop in like Northern Virginia and really found deep meaning in his ability to fabricate motorcycles.
Zen and the art of motorcycle
exactly,
maintenance.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks for the call, Don. Let's see if we can get a couple more calls in here. 866-733-6786. And let's go to Andy in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi there. Great show. Actually, it's sort of funny. I graduated with a degree in industrial arts, so I intended to become a shop instructor at one point. But my question is that it seems that the emphasis in today's classes are towards standardized tests and coming up on the common core. I was wondering how your guest sees these programs fitting within the standardized testing system and whether he feels that it would detract from the teacher's time taking away from instruction to the students for the test.
Yeah. Dale?
Well,
sounds like a worthwhile distraction.
Yes, absolutely. there's two points here. One is I really believe making is an alternative to this standardized curriculum and standardized testing model that we have here. It's if we really want creative, productive, engaged young learners, making offers them that. The standards don't. The Common Core standards, however, are moving in a direction where they're asking students to demonstrate their knowledge, not just like, do you know something? It's and that aligns, I think, more. You know, what I'm interested in is what can you do with what you know, not just what do you know. And I think it's a pivot on this that I think is an important one.
All right, Andy, thanks for the call. We've got a comment on the web here. Please explain Arduino. So many Maker Faire projects use Arduino, and it confuses me as to what exactly is done with it.
Well, I think in the simplest explanation is it's a small computer. It's a brain that you can put inside a project, but it's cheap. It's $35. And one of the reasons for growth of the maker movement is some of the technologies that are available. I mentioned 3D printing as an example, but Arduino is really one of the core technologies. It's cheap. It's pretty easy to use. It was actually designed for artists and designers rather than computer programmers. So it's not the most powerful thing in the world, but it just works. And
how might you use it?
Pardon me?
The
simplest thing is you might connect hardware, things like light. The beginning project is like I showed you to blink a light, right? But if you were creating a wearable project such as a sweater and you put conductive thread through that and it was attached to lights, you might have a small Arduino controller to say, okay, I'm going to turn them on in a certain pattern, and you would program that pattern and you would control that pattern through code. So it comes out of Italy, but it is a really important component or block for maker projects.
All right. Let's go now to Los Altos. Amita, welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much. This topic is very interesting to me. So I actually started an after-school and summer STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math camp because it was lacking so badly in our public school system. And it's turned out really well. And I just use, you know, like your guest was saying, just household things or experiments. You don't really need to buy very expensive things, and it's really fun. The kids, they usually don't even want to go home afterwards.
Yeah. Do you know, she brings up a great point that summer camps are a great introduction to making for kids. I've sponsored and organized some maker camps. We have a project with Google that starts in July called Maker Camp. It's just online and connects over 500 libraries and other places that are organizing physical camps. But, you know,
but again, you know, are these things, are these things accessible for kids, low-income kids?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Not enough. I mean, but I think programs like she's talking about, you know, we have a number of camps going out there. Really, the goal is to engage – kids can get in camp a more immersive experience. They can do this for hours and not be conflicted with a lot of other priorities. So I think camp is a great time to do this instead of summer school. We've seen this a few places where they've taken the, you know, here are the kids that are coming to summer school. Well, we'll make it more of a summer camp.
All right. Thanks very much, Amita, for the call. Here's a comment from a listener. A great class for interested makers is Design of Artifacts in Society, offered by University of Pennsylvania on Coursera. Takes you from ideas to prototype making to beta testing to alpha testing. You don't know if you're up on that.
Not particular, but you know, one of the things that I don't think we've talked enough about today is making and the makers as a source of innovation. And we see a lot of, like the caller called in with and said, I have an idea. And taking that idea to reality is easier. It's not easy, but it is easier than, say, 5 to 10 years ago. And so one of the makers that came to a White House Maker Faire is a San Francisco woman, Lisa Fetterman. And, you know, she gave a talk at an event we talked about. She came to San Francisco from China in 1994, didn't speak the language. She was a school child. She learned, liked food. And she got into sous vide cooking, which is like you heat things, you put things in plastic bags and you heat the water, and it's a very slow cooking method.
That's how my mother used to make bird's eye vegetables.
Exactly. But it takes, you know, the equipment for that was $1,000 or more to do it. Mm. So she created her own version. Mm. She raised money on Kickstarter, like $500,000 or so. And now she has a product in the market called Numiku.
We've got just a short time left, but what's the future of the maker movement? Where do you see it going?
Well, we're on the cusp right now of it almost sort of coming back into the mainstream. Making used to be a middle-class virtue. It was how you had a better car, a better home, a better life, I think. And I think I'd like to see it get back to that place again, where it's a capability. We use it in our home life. We use it in work. And we're proud of it. It's something that we see ourselves as having these powers to do stuff. And, you know, so I think it's a cultural transformation, but I'm really particularly want to focus on a transformation of education.
All right. Dale Doherty, fresh from the White House Maker Faire. Thanks for joining us. Founder of the Maker Faire and editor of Make Magazine. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, have a great weekend. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.